hppodcraft.com.
The eighth chapter is exceedingly brief and relates that Gibbons, the amateur naturalist of the district, while lying out on the spacious open downs without a soul within a couple of miles of him, as he thought, and almost dozing, heard close to him the sound as of a man coughing, sneezing, and then swearing savagely to himself, and, looking, beheld nothing. Yet the voice was indisputable. It continued to swear with that breadth and variety that distinguishes the swearing of a cultivated man. It grew to a climax, diminished again, and died away in the distance, going, as it seemed to him, in the direction of Adderdean. It lifted to a spasmodic sneeze and ended. Gibbons had heard nothing of the morning's occurrences, but the phenomenon was so striking and disturbing that his philosophical tranquillity vanished. He got up hastily and hurried down the steepness of the hill towards the village, as fast as he could go.
That is the eighth and shortest chapter of H.G. Wells' The Invisible Man.
Gibbons, we hardly knew you. If you'd stuck around longer, we could have introduced ourselves. Yeah. And it might have sounded a little like this. Hi, I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey, and you're listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
We're here at hppodcraft.com and Patreon. Holy smokes, who was that handsome reader?
That handsome reader is the glorious Greg Johnson. Greg Johnson, as you know, has a new album out. It's called Dr. Snake and the Snake Doctors.
Yes, I know.
It's really, really great songs in there. Check out all those songs on Bandcamp, Greg Johnson's Bandcamp page, and look for Dr. Snake and the Snake Doctors. It's good stuff.
And if you order now, Greg will murder one person of your choice. How's that for value?
Oh, jeez.
Yeah. He delivers a great product. Lots of amenities come with purchasing them.
Didn't see that on the website, but...
Yeah. Well, you heard it here first.
Okay. That's good to know.
So did Greg probably, but you know, I've said it out loud, so he's committed. Speaking of value, I am right now recording using equipment lent to me by the Six Demon Bag Podcast.
All right, yeah.
They have been generous in the past, lending us microphones and whatnot for those patent shows. Mm-hmm. They use their Zoom recorder for that. And Ryan Drossi and Jeff C. Carter over there heard about my bag issues and said, hey, you can use our gear.
Aww.
Our Six Demon Bag gear. So thanks so much for that. Folks, tune into the Six Demon Bag Podcast. They pull random topics for discussion related to writing, comics, movies, science, etc. They're doing this dueling horror review format right now called Put Up Your Spooks. I quite enjoy. They're really good fellas. Tune in. Check out that show. And thanks, guys. Thanks for letting
Thank you so much,
equipment, because the microphone I used last week, well, it made me seem a little disembodied, like the Invisible Man himself.
That's true.
When we last left you, we'd just gotten through the first fourth of the Invisible Man, and it was a literal farce. The Invisible Man shows up in the village of Iping, quite visible, in bandages and goggles and a fake nose. He takes a room at an inn and gets about some mysterious lab work in his room. All the while, the townspeople grow more and more curious about the stranger, proffering different theories. Maybe he's a ghost or a criminal. Nobody suggests that he's a mummy, which is maybe my only major issue with this book. But after they accuse him of stealing from the vicarage, which he did, to pay his rent... Things come to blows. Different folks try to apprehend him as he gets more and more naked, eventually becoming completely invisible again. He smacks a bunch of townspeople around in a fit and then runs off. And in that opening, we get a sense of his voyage. He's headed now toward Adderdean, and he has a bit of a cold. I was thinking about, you know, it's winter there, but I mean, could you imagine being an invisible man in the Midwest?
Oh, no. God, it would be terrible.
You'd only be able to smack people around and steal stuff for like 4 or 5 months out of the year.
Yeah.
The rest of the time, it'd be way too cold.
It's way too cold. Well, in England, it's cold as well. I mean, it's snowy there.
Yeah.
Remember when he arrived? Well, he arrived earlier. Now, I think it's April when all the stuff goes down. So it's springtime. But still, and you got to run around barefoot.
Yeah.
That sucks. And fighting somebody naked? That wouldn't be good.
I don't know. It might be good, but we can talk about that later. Chapter 9 is what we're into now. It's Mr. Thomas Marvel.
Thomas Marvel is the town eccentric. He's a bachelor, but kind of a homeless guy. But I think he's got a place, so he's not homeless. He's just poor, I think. And he plays a bit of a comic relief in this story.
But I get the impression he's somehow transient and instead of being a town eccentric, because when he gets into Iping later, they don't know who he is. No. I mean, or maybe he's the town eccentric of Adderdean, but
yeah,
kind of got the sense maybe he's a tramp. He's just moving through. He's fat around the middle with short limbs, and many of his buttons have been replaced by shoelaces or twine. So definitely a bachelor. And like you say, he's got that homeless vibe.
He's recently acquired some boots that he found in a leisurely manner in the trash, I guess. He comments on how ugly they are, and a disembodied voice answers, "They're boots anyhow." But Thomas, he just keeps talking to the voice like nothing's the matter. You know, everything's fine. Oh, somebody's talking to me. Okay, I'll just talk back. Maybe he thinks somebody's behind him or off to the side, but he doesn't turn to look. I don't know. So they talk about boots for a bit. And then when Mr. Marvel wants to look at the man he's talking to, he realizes that he can't see anybody. Mr. Marvel thinks he might be drunk or insane, but the voice tells him not to be alarmed.
It's funny to me that he says, "Am I drunk? Like, how would you forget that you're drunk?" I also like this dialogue when he says, "None of your ventriloquizing me." I also like that he asks, "Are you buried?" Which is a pretty reasonable one to ask, but I wouldn't have thought of it.
Well, I would think that you would be a lot more muffled if you were buried.
His theories are pretty strange.
You know, he's got some. Surprisingly.
He's definitely got some.
To get him to listen to reason, the Invisible Man starts throwing rocks at Mr. Marvel. See? Hallucinations don't throw rocks. But then Mr. Marvel just thinks that they're talking flying stones.
And one of them nails him on his big toe, hits him in the foot, and he jumps around. So it's kind of some broad comedy going on here as well.
So the voice explains that he's just an invisible man. He needs food and water and shelter. He breathes. He's a normal guy. He just happens to be invisible. Mr. Marvel asks to shake hands, and he does. And this kind of starts to win Mr. Marvel over. He scrutinized the apparently empty space keenly. "You haven't been eating bread and cheese," he asked, holding the invisible arm. "You're quite right, and it's not quite assimilated into the system." Now, how does he know what bread and cheese partially digested looks like?
From what I could tell in this book, that's all anybody eats in this entire area. So maybe it's just through familiarity. But yeah, that's a pretty odd one. I guess, you know, if he just ate them, it looks like some bread and cheese floating in midair.
Well, if you chew it up and then it gets all mixed in your gut.
Delicious.
And when he didn't notice it at first, this big thing of food floating in his stomach.
Well, if you don't know to look for it.
Or was it like semi-transparent?
Yeah, I don't know.
I remember the stuff being in that movie, Memoirs of an Invisible Man with Chevy Chase. Do you remember that movie?
Yeah, Chevy Chase and Daryl Hannah. Doesn't he chew some bubble gum in there? They've got all kinds of neat effects.
Yeah, I think that was like one of the first movies where they did the effects and you could actually see like the back of his collar on his shirt instead of it just got a guy wearing a green suit head.
Right, right. Is it a good movie? I don't remember. I liked it at the time.
I really liked it as a kid. Don't know if it's good or not.
This food thing was kind of suggested previously in the book, but it lays out yet another weakness for the Invisible Man. If he eats, you can see the food for a while.
Yeah.
Which is a pretty good weight loss plan if you think about it. I mean, I might not mindlessly eat a whole sleeve of Ritz crackers if you could see it floating around inside me for a while. That's a little more of a private decision, you know. Or if this were happening to you, I guess you could start eating as a form of fashion, like a bunch of pink icing or something, you know.
Oh, right.
Check me out.
Yeah, and you could mix different things together, like put the little candy sprinkles in there. And
exactly.
Yeah.
Have a sparkly esophagus.
So now Mr. Marvel's getting it. He's very impressed. But the Invisible Man downplays the whole situation. Mr. Marvel wants to know how he did it, but the Invisible Man says it's a long story, and he just leaves it at that. He says he needs help, and he turned to Mr. Marvel because he too is an outcast. The Invisible Man needs help getting clothes and shelter.
But it does imply that he almost randomly murdered him. He says, "What I want to say at present is this. I need help. I have come to that. I came upon you suddenly. I was wandering, mad with rage, naked, impotent. I could have murdered, and I saw you, I came up behind you, hesitated, went on, then stopped. Here, I said, as an outcast like myself, this is the man for me." So it's, I think he almost just brained him to release some pressure, you know, just
because he's angry,
tension, because he's angry. But then he goes, "Oh, wait, no, this guy's a tramp, so he has some of the same issues as me, finding food and shelter and clothing."
So the Invisible Man says, "Help me out and I will do awesome stuff for you, but betray me." And, you know, basically he scares Mr. Marvel into complying.
And this is another cool thing about the predicament of the Invisible Man. He needs to find Confederates or he's way too vulnerable. It's an inherent conflict that goes on for the rest of this book because, you know, who wants to work for an invisible naked guy? Nobody.
Well, it doesn't sound so bad.
These days, I'll take it. Chapter 10 gets us into Mr. Marvel's visit to Iping.
After the Invisible Man runs off, people calm down and a wave of skepticism rolls in. Was this guy really invisible? Was it some kind of conjuring trick? The only one who really saw the Invisible Man was Mr. Wadgers, who was hiding in the house, and Jaffers, who stunned on the floor of the coach and horses.
Stunned, we discover. So not dead, as we imagined when we last left off.
Yes.
The Invisible Man has not yet murdered anybody that we know of.
That we know of. People get on with the festivities of Whit Monday, though there is a slight uneasiness in the air.
I mean, what are you going to not party just because somebody might be invisible? The only person who isn't partying is old Fletcher, whose conceptions of holiday making were severe. and he was visible through the jasmine about his window, poised delicately on a plank, supported on two chairs and whitewashing the ceiling of his front room. He's like, I'm doing some work today. But yeah. I'm going to make sure you all see me.
Right. At 4 in the afternoon that day, a stranger comes to town, and it's Thomas Marvel. He's looking for the coach and horses, and he finds his way there. He then tries to get into the Invisible Man's room, but he's caught by Mr. Hall, who tells him that it's a private room. This guy, Mr. Huckster, notices Mr. Marvel being kind of sketchy.
Yeah, Huckster's in the shop across the street, and he sees Mr. Marvel waiting around, apparently talking to himself, loitering. And then Huckster sees him suddenly turn and vanish into the yard of the inn, and he's like, that dude's up to something. And so he runs out to apprehend him. Just at that moment, Marvel comes back out with a big bundle and a blue tablecloth in one hand and three books tied together.
Huckster yells, "Stop, thief!" Huckster chases after Marvel, but mysteriously he trips. I mean, he was running hard, so when he trips, he goes flying through the air and smashes into the ground.
Which gets us into chapter 11 in The Coach and Horses.
So this chapter is a bit of a rewind to the interior of the inn while Mr. Marvel was loitering. Earlier that day, Dr. Cuss and Vicar Bunting were going through the Invisible Man's stuff, trying to figure out who he is. So Dr. Cuss finds three large books labeled Diary. Unfortunately, they're all written in a cipher code. Mathematical, Russian, Greek?
Yeah, there's a bit of funny character work where Cuss says, I think some of this is in Greek, so you can translate that, Bunting. And Bunting's like, yeah, but let me look at everything first before I get to work on that. So clearly, Bunting has told people he knows Greek, but he's never been called on it.
Right.
And he's all nervous in this moment because he's a liar.
Yeah.
He doesn't know any Greek, or at least he can't read it enough. Well, to be of any help here.
Yeah. Well, being a vicar, I think a lot of the original New Testament stuff was written in Greek.
Right.
So maybe that was part of his studies and he just kind of slacked off.
Right. Well, he's like, man, I wish something would happen so I don't get embarrassed here. And then suddenly
the door opens and it's Marvel. And he says, tap. And they tell him it's across the hall. And he leaves. This is Marvel letting the Invisible Man into the room.
Uh-huh.
Bunting feels something on his neck, and then his face is pushed to the table. A voice says, don't move, little men, or I'll brain you both.
Yeah, looking over, he can see that Cuss is in the same situation. So the Invisible Man has grabbed the backs of their necks and slammed both their faces onto the table.
He's so violent.
Yeah.
Just mean. The Invisible Man wants to know where his clothes are. He plays the victim a bit here. He does also mention that he could kill them both and get away with it, so they had best help him out. The nights are getting cold, and he needs clothes, some accommodations, and his three books.
And then into chapter 12, the Invisible Man loses his temper. So we know this isn't going to go well.
So while the Invisible Man is going nuts on Cuss and Bunting, Mr. Hall and Henfrey are sitting and talking together. They hear noises and a strange smell coming from the parlor.
Right, so they're going to go check this out.
So the door is locked and Hall asks, is everything okay? And Vicar Bunting lets out a duressed, quite right, please don't interrupt.
There's clearly something going on in there. They can hear this muffled sound of conversation, hissing whispers, it says.
Hall and Henfrey eavesdrop on the room. Mrs. Hall catches them and tells them they shouldn't be doing that, and they go away. So what is this all about? It's Hall's place. What does he think they're doing in there?
What does he think they're doing in there? He doesn't know. That's the reason he's listening, but she's going, hey, you're eavesdropping. That's rude.
Yeah, but like, okay, so these guys went in and they're trying to investigate like the Invisible Man.
Right.
But then they're being all sketchy in there. It's his house. Why couldn't he go in and check? I just think it's funny that his wife is like, hey, this isn't your business. It's like, it's totally his business.
That's true.
Henfrey says he hears the parlor window open and then they hear Huckster yelling, stop, thief.
So that was when the Invisible Man, you know, handed all the stuff off to Marvel. In the earlier scene, we'd seen him running away with it. So it's cool how we get these three different perspectives on the same scene.
So at that point, all three run out to see Huckster running and then trip on something and fall hard, knocking himself out. More people turn up and run over to see what happened, and they fall down, and it becomes a big mess of people.
Yeah, the farce cranks up again. And I can't help but be juvenile and laugh because the Invisible Man is running around tackling people and smacking them around, and he's totally naked. It does add some absurdity to it.
Uses the phrase, indecorous sprawl.
Well, right, everybody just keeps running into each other, bashing heads and falling.
Well, and then he keeps pushing them down, and they don't know what the heck's going on. So Huckster stumbles back to the coach and horses and hears the Invisible Man angrily talking as if he's been hurt in the scuffle. Cuss yells to Bunny to get out of there. The Invisible Man has gone fighting mad. So Bunting freaks out, climbs out the window to escape, and then he runs up the hill.
Just possibly the Invisible Man's original intention was simply to cover Marvel's retreat with the clothes and books, but his temper had no time very good. Seems to have gone completely at some chance blow, and forthwith he set to smiting and overthrowing for the mere satisfaction of hurting. You must figure the street full of running figures, of doors slamming and fights for hiding places. Everywhere there is a sound of closing shutters and shoving bolts, and the only visible humanity is the occasional eye flitting under a raised eyebrow in the corner of a window pane. So everything goes crazy in the street, and then everybody runs to get behind closed doors because the Invisible Man is afoot.
The Invisible Man has gone ballistic and just starts breaking all the windows of the coach and horses, and then he shoves a street lamp through a window of some random lady's house. He then cuts the telegraph wire, and then he's just gone. Mm-hmm. But it was the best part of 2 hours before any human being ventured out again into the desolation of Iping Street.
Yeah, they're pretty scared by all this, as I imagine.
Yeah.
I mean, it got a little more serious in this iteration of it. It wasn't quite as farcical. This time it got a little more violent, you know, smashing windows and trying to cut off communication so that people don't know he's coming to the next town. Gets us into chapter 13, Mr. Marvel discusses his resignation.
So Mr. Marvel is walking back to Bramblehurst with the Invisible Man yelling at him and threatening him. The Invisible Man thinks Mr. Marvel was trying to give him the slip and escape, and he threatens to kill Marvel if he tries it again. He's also pissed at the people of Iping for blowing his secret. The Invisible Man is very verbally abusive to Marvel.
Of course.
Marvel says that he's a terrible tool for him. And he tries to convince the Invisible Man that he should get somebody else to help him, but the Invisible Man just ignores him.
It's a pathetically funny scene. You know, he's like, I'm not strong, I'm out of shape, I'm not that bright. I'm going to be a really bad assistant. It's like a reverse interview, you know, or like a bullshit breakup. You know, hey, someday you're going to find somebody great that you deserve. I'm just in a bad place. I shouldn't be dating anybody. My head's a mess. I'm bad at sex. You got to do you, girl. That's what he's trying to do.
Wait, have you ever broken up with somebody and said, I'm bad at sex?
No, but that's a good one, huh? Head's a mess, I'm bad at sex. He is bad at sex. So I shouldn't be hurt by this.
Boy, you know what? That really hurt, too, if you said that. And then she goes, yeah, I know. It's okay, though.
I didn't want to say anything, but thanks for letting me talk.
Mr. Marvel and the Invisible Man go through a little village, and the Invisible Man tells Marvel that he will have his hand on Marvel's shoulder. So if he tries anything, he'll get what for.
Gets us to chapter 14 at Port Stowe.
Now, we jump ahead to 10 the next morning, where Mr. Marvel is all tired and dirty and sitting on a bench outside an inn in Port Stowe. Port Stowe, I looked it up. It's not a real place.
You know, when you Google the Invisible Man, there's a section that says people also ask in the Google search results.
Oh, okay.
And the number one question is the Invisible Man a true story? Like, what? Who's searching that? I mean, I thought maybe they're talking about Invisible Man by Ralph Ellison, which is a book from the 50s about racial inequality and definitely draws from real life.
Yes.
I hope that's what people are wondering about, because if this had all really happened, the contents of this book, there wouldn't be just a novel about it from H.G. Wells. Yeah. It'd be a pretty big deal that this happened. There would be a whole channel of bad documentaries about it running on cable all day long. Anyway, Mr. Marvel is nervously sitting on a bench in Port Stowe.
A mariner comes and sits next to him and makes small talk about the weather, but the mariner hears the sound of coins dropping.
Yeah, like they're dropping into Marvel's pocket. It's odd. He seems to have a lot of dough on him.
He asks Marvel about the books and then tells him about strange stuff in the newspaper. It seems the Invisible Man has made it into the newspapers.
Mm-hmm.
Marvel pretends not to know what he's talking about, and the mariner tells him that the Invisible Man was supposed to have been in Iping. The mariner tells him about an article which recounts the events on Whit Monday, and Marvel asks if the Invisible Man had returned to Iping. The mariner says, well, he didn't, as far as anybody knows. And rumor has it that the Invisible Man could be on his way to Port Stowe. The mariner says he's creeped out by the idea of an Invisible Man sneaking around and all the shady things that he could be getting up to. Mr. Marvel mentions that he knows something about the Invisible Man, and he starts to talk about him. Then Marvel says, ow! And he says, oh, I got a toothache. But, of course, you know, it's obviously the Invisible Man who's standing near him, and he's course-correcting him. And then the mariner wants to know more, but then Marvel goes, oh, you know what? Actually, what I heard is the whole thing's a hoax. And the mariner, he gets really angry because he said, wait, you just said that you knew stuff about the Invisible Man.
Yeah.
Are you trying to make me a fool?
He's like, why did you let me go on about these articles and stuff if you knew it was a hoax? I talked a lot about this and you just listened to it. He genuinely seems hurt. Why would you do that to me?
Yeah. So they get in an argument until the Invisible Man jerks Marvel away and the mariner is very confused.
Yeah, because he walks away all crazy-like because, you know, he's being dragged away.
So the mariner also hears someone saw a fistful of money floating around, and then someone tried to grab it, but they were hit by an unseen force.
Mm.
It was 10 days after, and indeed only when the Burdock story was already old, that the mariner collated these facts and began to understand how near he had been to the wonderful Invisible Man.
Pretty cool. Like, oh, wow. He was standing right next to me and I didn't even know it. It's kind of like how I was at that one Halloween party. Well, you were there too. And I talked to Elijah Wood for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't know it was him because he had all this face paint on. Just thought he was, you know, some other dude. Happened to be named Elijah. I don't know why I didn't put two and two together. You guys had to tell me later. I talked to him for a long time too. And then later he told me, I went, oh. It was a lot like this is what I'm saying. And he played Frodo Baggins, who is another invisible man.
True.
So you see, it comes full circle. Chapter 15, The Man Who Was Running.
Now we have Dr. Kemp. He's looking out of his window over Burdock. He's got a bunch of science books. He's a young guy with very bright, light blonde hair and a mustache.
The work he was upon would earn him, he hoped, the fellowship of the Royal Society, so highly did he think of it. So this is our sober, skeptical, calm character. We haven't met him yet, but you immediately sense that he has some importance to the story.
Yes, he sees a short man running over a hill toward him, and this is Marvel, right?
Yeah.
So he thinks it's one of those fools that thinks that there's an invisible man about. And this guy is running very hard, but he doesn't seem to be getting anywhere. Like he has lead in his pockets, is what he says.
Yeah.
And the closer it gets, Dr. Kemp can see this guy is an abject terror.
It's pretty cinematic, this bit, because there are hills and houses. So Marvel is running way off in the distance and then disappears. And then appears closer and then disappears again. Then reappears again. And each time it reveals more oddness about how scared he is. It seems like he's got all this lead in his pockets. And people are wondering why this guy's running so hard. There's a lot of people coming out of their houses. What's going on? And then, far up the hill, a dog playing in the road yelped and ran under a gate. And as they still wondered something, a wind, a pad, 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 a sound like a panting breathing rushed by. They've been reading the papers, so they go, uh-oh, we know what this is.
Right. So everyone in town starts freaking out and screaming, locking themselves in their houses. They yell, "The Invisible Man is coming!"
That's a good Queen song, The Invisible Man.
Is it?
You know, actually, I don't know. It's a Queen song, I'll tell you that.
It is a Queen song, that's true.
Then we have chapter 16 in the Jolly Cricketers.
So we got two blokes hanging out at the Jolly Cricketers and they hear all this commotion. The barman thinks it might be a fire, but then Marvel comes bursting in trying to close the door behind him, but it's hooked on a strap. Marvel yells, "The Invisible Man is after me, help!" A policeman fixes the door and then closes it while asking what Marvel is on about. Marvel is just going nuts talking about how the Invisible Man is going to kill him. Then there's a loud knock at the door. The policeman goes to open it, but Marvel begs him not to. The policeman then hides Marvel behind the bar, and the window smashes in, and then there's a scream in the street.
Man, Invisible Man's going nuts.
The policeman looks outside and sees nothing, as he would, but Marvel says that the Invisible Man is going to go around the back. That's his strategy. He distracts.
Yeah, the Invisible Man is focused on getting to Marvel. I mean, he is after him.
The door bursts open and the Invisible Man grabs Marvel, starts dragging him into the kitchen. Men jump on what they think is the Invisible Man. This causes the Invisible Man to scream at them and he knocks them aside and he escapes and all the men rush outside.
The men in the kitchen found themselves clutching at and struggling with empty air. "Where has he gone?" cried the man with the beard. "Out? This way," said the policeman, stepping into the yard and stopping. A piece of tile whizzed by his head and smashed among the crockery on the kitchen table. "I'll show him," shouted the man with the black beard, and suddenly a steel barrel shone over the policeman's shoulder, and five bullets had followed one another into the twilight whence the missile had come. As he fired, the man with the beard moved his hand in a horizontal curve so that his shots radiated out into the narrow yard like spokes from a wheel. A silence followed. "Five cartridges," said the man with the black beard. "That's the best of all. Four aces and a joker. Get a lantern, someone, and come and feel about for his body."
Oh, man. Once again, we're on a cliffhanger here. Is the Invisible Man dead?
Oh, my God.
Did he get him with that gunfire?
He's dead.
And that's the end.
That's the end of the story. Well,
I hope you all enjoyed it.
It's actually not the end of the story. That's halfway through the story, and the rest of it is about his funeral.
That's right.
And the whole rest of the book.
A bunch of people we haven't met before come in and reminisce about him and his invisibility.
Yep.
No, that's not what happens. This is but the farce here suddenly does turn violent. I mean, that ratchets it up a bit with the gunfire. And the Invisible Man sort of single-minded homicidal attacks on Marvel.
I really dig the gradual build of things. Like, it starts off, you're kind of on the Invisible Man's side.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's kind of fun. He's doing fun stuff. And then he kind of gets a little bit mean. And then he just gets really mean.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah.
So it's like it's a ride. You know, like things keep getting changed up. It's interesting. It's very exciting. It moves so quickly. And it's a great story. They should have high schoolers read this story. It's not part of the curriculum, is it? You never have read it in school.
No, I read it on my own. I don't know if it's taught in schools, although I think it'd be a great book for junior
It's
high.
So good. That it's level, just such a fun, cool story. And like you said, it gets you thinking about being invisible. And like all the, there's like, wow, that would be hard. Because, okay, great, you can steal stuff. But if you steal it, people can see the stuff that you've stolen. It'll be floating around.
Yeah, well, that's why you need a confederate, which is an interesting. Which is
exactly.
Interesting.
So you gotta get somebody in on it, which is something that never would have occurred to me.
Yeah, well, it's fun because Wells sets up something. Well, the Invisible Man himself says this as we get into the next section, where he's like, all I could think of were the benefits.
Yeah.
The drawbacks didn't occur to me at all. And Wells doesn't even spend any time with the benefits, really. He goes right into the drawbacks right away. This guy shows up dressed in bandages and everybody thinks he's weird. It's a problem right to begin with. So it's a fun way that he tackled it. And, you know, this book structurally also has a lot in common with Jekyll and Hyde, as well as the certain themes it has in common with. But if I recall, that book gave you a first half that was full of fun and mystery.
Yes.
Not quite as fun as this, but, you know, it was just this odd figure who was beating people with sticks and nobody knew who he was and what's this all about. And then right at the midpoint, things switch up a bit and we get into the explanation, the backstory. Right. How did this all come to be?
And that's where we're getting to in this story.
Yes. Next episode, we'll get the backstory on the Invisible Man, the dark story behind his weird science that created this condition. And that stuff's really interesting because he hits on a dozen other things that are drawbacks to this that I didn't think about either.
Yeah, I know. It's really fun, and it makes you think about the whole thing, and it's really kind of a curse is my one.
Yeah,
anything.
It's more of a curse, definitely, especially if you can't do it at will. You know, once you're in, the process is somewhat irreversible. I mean, that's what he was trying to figure out at the beginning of the book, is how to reverse it and get out of this predicament, or at least do it at will.
But we'll get to that next week.
We'll get to that, though. If you did teach this, I think there would be so much that you could unpack, aside from the very good storytelling and story structure.
Oh, yeah.
As you say, the implications of being invisible. It's really a discussion of morality.
Yes, absolutely. And being able to talk about, well, just because you could do something, would you do something? Could you still be moral and be invisible? Or having this kind of power over people, would that make you start doing crappy things?
Well, it's a discussion of, you know, what is the efficacy of laws, for example. We pass laws. It's odd, people, you know, we pass laws, but it doesn't necessarily keep people from doing the things we pass laws. So do you need the laws? I mean, because some people will argue in certain cases, well, why make laws? People are going to do this anyway. Well then why have any laws, right?
Why have any laws? Yeah, exactly.
Because hopefully there is some discouragement involved.
I'm sure there's lots of things that are illegal that people don't do because they're illegal.
Absolutely.
And, you know, like, especially road laws. I know I obey the speed limit because I know it's illegal and I might get a ticket. If there wasn't a law, I would drive faster. I know I would.
Yeah. But then there's other things where people say if you don't have law, then it's going to turn into pandemonium, like murder, for example.
Oh, right.
Yes, I think it's important to have laws against murdering people.
Yeah.
But I also think that in the absence of laws, people wouldn't just be like, well, now I get to do some murdering. Like, I don't think that people by nature, some of these things that I think in religious structures we feel we have to.
Yes.
You know, if we don't have the rule of God set up, then people are just going to be crazy animals.
That's one I remember Penn Jillette talking about. He's like, where people go, if there's no God, then people are just going to go out and rape people. They're going to rape as much as they want. And he goes, well, here's the thing. I'm raping exactly as much as I want right now, which is zero. I don't want to rape anybody.
Yeah.
Like, people don't want to generally do bad things. Like, it's not like the law or a fear of God is holding me back from doing all these horrible things. It's just mean. I don't want to do mean things. I like doing nice things.
But see, this is why this opens up such an interesting discussion, because now we're getting into the underpinnings of society. You know, when is law necessary? Why do we have rules? Why do we have a strong government? In people in a state of nature, do they tend toward anarchy or do they organize on their own? I mean, there's a lot to be unpacked just by talking about a man becoming invisible, which is why I think it shows up in Plato's Republic and in literature constantly, this idea of I have a secret thing that I can use to make me invisible.
It's a lot of cool stuff in the story and it's fun. That's all I can say about it. It's super fun. But you know what else is fun? Dr. Snake and the Snake Doctors.
Man.
Greg Johnson's new album. Please check it out on Bandcamp. If you do a search, you'll find it right away.
Right.
It's a great album. Lots of fun. Good songs. Give it a listen.
Yeah. And if you have an unhealthy snake, you don't play the album for them, they'll get better. These are snake doctors. Professional snake doctors. We have some patrons I'd like to thank.
Oh, my God. Yes. Let's thank these people.
Yeah. Let's thank them. I want to start by thanking Ben Mund.
I would like to thank Ken Ringwald.
I'd like to thank Ryan Hall.
Thank you, Lepra One.
Leprawan. Oh, man. That's a great handle. I want to thank Brittany Elmer.
I'd like to thank Jim Gannon.
I would like to thank Cliffy Matheson.
I'd like to thank Robert.
Stephen Owens, thank you so much.
And of course, Carl, thank you.
Thank you, Carl. That's all we've got for this week. We'll be back with more Invisible Man next week. Thanks for tuning in, folks. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
HPPodcraft.com.